There is a big talent problem in the energy transition.
Where do you make the trade-off between the skills versus the energy experience versus the availability versus other factors? Is there's a big convergence of multiple technologies. So, you know, you can't just look at storage and batteries in isolation without thinking about, you know, grid connections, or you can't think about solar without thinking about storage. You can't think of EV charging without thinking about power. So that there's much more of a need for leaders to be aware of broader market conditions and other parts of the market, lots of moving parts. Because it's very difficult, or next to impossible, to define a strategy for your storage business or your solar business or your EV charging business without looking at the market in a more holistic way.
Hello and welcome back to Transmission. As the energy industry evolves, the skills and approaches in overcoming emerging challenges needs to change too. This week, David Hunt, CEO of Hyperion Executive Search, joins Quentin to explore the challenges in finding the skills and talent needed to get us to net zero. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a review wherever you listen. Let's jump in.
Hello, David. Welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
And if you recognize that voice, that's, of course, David Hunt from Hyperion Executive Search, who does a marvelous podcast. Before we get off the blocks, if you're not subscribed to David's podcast, go and check it out. They've had some awesome guests. 150 episodes, something like that?
Just about to hit 150, yeah.
150, and you've been going a bit longer than us.
Yeah, it's taken a while. We started almost 4 years ago, but we've been sort of, I guess, running a few series and every other week. But yeah, 150 is quite exciting.
And you do the, let's get stuck into it. So what's Hyperion as a search firm? And how did you get into doing the podcast?
Very quickly. So I started Hyperion 10 years ago, actually just over 10 years ago. It's been an executive search firm or headhunters exclusively in cleantech, because previously I'd actually been running a solar EPC and developer. So we work exclusively within clean technology. And it found ourselves quite quickly getting working primarily with scale-ups, startups, post-investment startups and scale-ups. And it just became fascinatingly interesting. And talking to our clients about their individual entrepreneur journeys was just, for me, really exciting and interesting. And I thought there would be value to the markets to hear some of those stories, because it's not easy, right? As you well know yourself, it's not easy to start a business and scale a business. So I started just thinking, well, how can we share those stories and add value to the marketplace? So I started interviewing entrepreneurs, basically, and founders, but all in cleantech, and thus leaders in cleantech, and it evolved from there.
And it's a lot of work to do a podcast like this. So do you have a team? How big's Hyperion? And then who does the podcast editing, production? We've got the marvelous Izzy, who's sat with us here right now, who gets it all.
I might headhunter, actually.
You won't be the first to say that. No, but Izzy's very happy at Modo, aren't you? But it's a lot of work.
It is.
So who does it all for you?
It used to be mostly myself, and obviously it is quite onerous when you're trying to run a business as well, because it started essentially as a side hustle. It wasn't intended to commercialize it at all, and it kind of got legs and become much more of a thing, and it took up more of my time. So we now use a studio in Liverpool, so they mostly do all of the editing and posting and sort of pre and post-production kind of stuff. In terms of organization, we have a small marketing team, so they help with organization and then disseminating the podcasts. But still effectively, they'll probably bear most of the brunt. But I enjoy it because, it's conversations, and it's most of the clients, not all, most are clients of Hyperion and or wannabe clients or would-be clients of Hyperion. So it kind of has a duality of it. But yeah, it is much more hard work than most people think.
And what are your favorite episodes? I really enjoyed, well, I'll let you go first. But.
No, do tell. It's hard. It's always like, which is your favorite baby? Sort of the dismiss people. But I think, yeah, there have been some people who open up. You know what it's like in the conversations? Occasionally you get people, despite them being fairly gregarious of nature, it takes a bit of work to get stories out of them. And others are more keen to share. Certainly, I think some of the storage episodes have been great fun and have got good traction. So Ascend Elements, for example, when we had those guys on in the US before they came to Europe. It was hard to pinpoint. I think it's just a guess where the conversation meanders away from necessarily, we never script like yourself, but we have some themes, but it's where those conversations become two-way and not just a question and answer.
Yeah, I enjoyed David from PV Case.
Yes.
I enjoyed that. That was a good conversation. I mean, there's plenty in the archive. So yeah, if you're listening, go check it out. Let's move on from podcasting and talk about what we're here to talk about, which is there is a big talent problem in the energy transition.
Yeah.
And you guys know probably more about that than anyone. And we're going to dig into now where the gaps are, the skills gap and the hiring gaps, and how companies are resolving that. and what some of the challenges are for the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
Because we need tons more people working on energy transition stuff.
Yeah.
So we need to accept that many of them won't have the skills and experience. You're not going to have 10 years, job description that says 5 years experience in grid scale batteries is probably there's not that many people out there.
Yeah.
So we've got some big problems to solve.
Yeah.
Where should we start? When companies come to you, what are they generally looking for and what do you hire for?
Primarily, they are looking for the 10 years experience in markets that have been established for 5 years. So that's, I guess, the needle in the haystack, which is essentially why you come to a search firm and why we've been very successful, because we can do that. But it does present the challenges, as you say, that it's a very limited talent pool. I think perhaps to make some clarity, we recruit primarily strategically important hires, so board level, C-suite, heads of, VPs, so sort of more strategic, new boots on new countries, expansion kind of roles. That there's a huge demand though from that level through to, you know, blue collar. So clearly just actually physically implementing our project managing infrastructure, whether it's solar or storage or EV charging infrastructure, there's massive demand there. And I think that's important. And we try and voice that as much as we can to governments and that there's a skills issue and a jobs opportunity there. But it's equally the case at executive and senior level. The challenges are a little bit different because obviously in terms of scale, there's less of those jobs, but there's also still a very small talent pool of experienced people. So then it's the challenge of, you know, where do you make the trade-off between the skills versus the energy experience versus the availability versus other factors? And that's kind of where we work with clients to try and come up with a solution. That most of the time, to be fair, does require people from industry, but we've been blessed and we still push to look at where appropriate a transference of skills. So could somebody come from, and the obvious one is, you know, solar and storage and solar, but things like from telecoms or oil and gas or other sort of more established industries where people can bring a set of skills and the learning curve isn't perhaps quite so steep.
And the big elephant in the room that, on top of that, is the diversity question, mm-hmm. which is just such a challenge in our industry.
Yeah,
I mean, it's something that we struggle with it. I mean, to get it out there, we really struggle with it because we've used search firms, and we often requirements to use a search firm is that we want a diverse pipeline,
yeah.
right? And we've had search firms turn around and say, "You just not." No, we can't do that, or your requirements on that are too high. Mm. It's a real challenge to get the balance right between finding pipeline, actually candidates,
yeah,
and also not positively discriminating because that's illegal,
yeah,
and figuring out this whole thing. I mean, so when folks come to you and say we are looking for diverse pipelines, how do you resolve that? Where do you go looking in? For pool, where are the pools of candidates where you can, I'm actually asking as a favor, you can tell me, where are the pools of candidates you can go so you can make sure that you are getting people not just with Oxbridge degrees who look a certain way and act a certain way,
yeah.
No disrespect to Oxbridge degrees, but you're also dipping into pools of talent where people didn't have the same opportunities. How are you thinking about that as a search firm?
You've got to be consistent and determined to do so. It's not easy. We're very proud of that. In 2022, 42% of our hires were female, which in clean tech, you know, primarily a lot of tech companies as well that we work with, that was quite a stretch. It wasn't quite so strong last year, but it took quite a few years really of looking at not just where to look, which is one aspect, but how to actually approach and how to engage with people in those marketplaces, how to be a trusted source of conversation for people, whether it's from gender diversity or other obviously forms of diversity, which are important as well. For us, we set about, funnily enough, talking about energy storage, it was working with a client called Orenco, which you may know, Orenco Group with Rupert Newland, and they very quickly said exactly that. We need a diverse shortlist. We're a bunch of four guys, all from Imperial, all white middle-class guys, great at what we do, but that's what we are, so we need diversity. And we sat down with them and then started to internally formulate a plan to, okay, so where do we go to look for these people? How can we tell a story to people in those markets or lesser sort of obvious places to be? So engaging with people like powerful women in science and education, some of the sort of black and minority ethnic trade groups and associations and communities. So I think the challenge for other people is it's not something you can dip in and out of or just say, oh, do you know what, we'll say we're looking for diversity or we'll spin something quickly. You need to really be seen and credible and consistent in those markets to be able to have people willing to reach out to you or respond to your responses as a headhunter. to accept and acknowledge that you're going to be treated equally. If you might not have, say, the Oxford degree, or you might not even have any degree potentially, depending on the nature of the role, but still feel confident to be able to say, actually, I can have a conversation with these people.
Yeah, we like hiring wildcards. So people who don't have a background in energy, we call them wildcards because they wouldn't technically meet the requirements of the job description in the experience sector, but there's something about them. We've got lots of people like that who come from other sectors.
Yeah. It works out, doesn't it? I mean, that's one of the things we call them curveballs. So we're on a shortlist. We'll try and find diversity on the shortlist as much as we possibly can, but we'll also try and include a curveball or two in there as well. And quite often, to your point, it's the curveball that gets the job because they offer something a little bit different.
Yeah, probably worth mentioning, two white guys talking about diversity is probably not the best people to represent this conversation full stop, but yeah, it's a tricky one. I want to talk about salaries, because there's something funny going on, which is that we're noticing that there is a big difference between average and the best talent.
Mm-hmm.
So salaries, like a 10x person is now starting to earn a lot more money.
Yeah.
There's also a big locational element now. So we're seeing a big difference between London salaries and outside of London. Same as in the US, we're seeing, you know, Austin and New York and the Bay Area. And it's almost like a reversal from what happened in COVID. It feels like we're an in-person business. So we Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, everyone is together in one of our offices. That's very important to us.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're willing to pay for that, for the best talent. And talk more about our salary policy if interested. But what's going on with salaries in this sector, and what trends are you seeing?
I think what's going to touch us back to your original point is that there's a very short talent pool. So demand outstrips supply by a significant factor. And when those markets suddenly get hot, that becomes accelerated. So for a period of time, it has been in storage. Probably in the last 18 months, the EV charging infrastructure e-mobility sector has gone through that ultra hype. There's been a lot of investment coming in, therefore a lot of growth, and therefore a lot of demand for talent. And then that obviously spikes then the salary levels to a level which is not healthy, really. Because what happens, going back to your point there, is that the A players probably deserve and will be a good return on investment even at those salaries.
100%.
But what happens is that everybody else that's a B player kind of then suddenly expects and gets elevated salaries. And we speak to some bang average people on some huge salaries. And it's like, you know, so it does make it hard if you are then on the other end, you're trying to scale. Even if you've got VC money or from ever, you still got to be responsible in terms of, you know, utilizing that capital wisely. And oftentimes salary and or hiring is a massive cost for people, one of the bigger costs in many operations. But it is a problem when you get these spikes, and it tends to follow investment. Where there's a lot of investment goes, then a lot of growth clearly you want, and hiring happens, and then those markets become overheated. And then you find, as we say, people that are sort of, you know, average to poor sometimes on some very good salaries, which you can say is good for them. But the flip side is when markets turn and things become tough, you're out the door. You know, economics are economics. And if you end up getting an inflated salary and the markets changes and you're not effectively returning the value of that cost, you're out the door. So it's, you could say it's great for candidates, but I don't think it is. I think a balanced and fair market is what's the better thing. And again, that is the challenge. If you're looking for great people, they are expensive, and it's not always easy to separate the person that you're looking for with some of those costs versus, I should say, some of the location issues or other factors as well.
What are you noticing about in-office work and location? What's the last few years look like? What trends are there?
It's definitely trending back to a hybrid stroke office. I don't think it will trend back to a full office. I think COVID has taught us all, as we all know, that, you know, you can do things remotely, and you do. But certainly for the first probably 2-3 years after COVID, 2 years, then 80% of our roles were remote. The exceptions were if you're in a lab, for example, or you're a CTO, you had to be physically where stuff was being built or made or innovation was happening. But it was significantly biased towards remote. We've seen in the last year or so that's drifted back to more people wanting at least a hybrid model. Good example at the moment, actually, is we're recruiting for a client with an office in Hamburg and Amsterdam, and they require, again, 3 days of the week in the office. But on the flip side, then they are willing to, and other companies are willing to contribute a little bit to that relocation if necessary.
Yeah, I mean, we tried everything. We tried one day, we tried remote, we tried in office, and then we surveyed everyone I mean, I had a pretty strong belief in office in general. So I must say I'm very biased towards being in office. I think as a growth, the rate of growth that we want to achieve, I think that kind of works best when you're together. Then we surveyed everyone. What we found is people didn't really care. They just didn't want to go into an office if it was half full. Yeah. They wanted to go into a busy office or not at all. And so we said, right, we're going to set these days. And it's worked really, really well for us. And I think probably a year, 18 months ago, we had candidates pushing back on it. And now we have pretty much nobody pushes back on it. And in fact, people say they want that. They really want to be in person.
It comes down to most things about culture. And obviously that is a big part of culture in terms of how and where you interact. I think one of the things that originally people were reluctant to, and still now, is if you go to the office, it's say everybody's in the office, and you come to the office and spend your day on a Zoom call, there's no point you being there.
Yeah.
So it's actually, how do you utilize those days when you are in the office differently from when people are remote? And I'm sure that's part of what you do, is that you have that collaboration time, or you use the time that people are in the office in a way that you couldn't do quite so comfortably or easily remotely. You don't bring people in the office because they should be in the office and then get them to sit in a cubicle and spend the day on a Zoom call or just with a head and a laptop, because they could do that anyway.
No. And also, I mean, we have some great fun. I mean, I'm a big believer that work should be fun.
Yep.
And because I think that's how you're going to get the best out of people. And I think fun, you know, there's limited fun you can have in your own house on your own all day. I don't have any fun in my house. Yeah. Oh, well, I do have fun in my house, sorry, my family, but certainly not on my own.
Yeah.
So let's think about these hotspots then for a second. So where's the hype at the moment in the jobs market?
Coming back to the point of more in your office, geographically there are hotspots. Clearly in the US, you've noted a couple. I mean, Austin's is hot. Of course, the West Coast is very hot. New York's very hot. In Europe, Berlin, Barcelona, Amsterdam, hotspots, because there's a lot of clean tech startups investment going on there. So the geographical hotspots. In terms of market sectors, then anything around storage and grid, optimization and flexibility are clearly massive topics, as you very well know, and where there's a lot of interest and a lot of investment going into that. So that's still hot. There has been a slight cooling and even a reversing in some regards in EV charging infrastructure and in the e-mobility space. A bit of consolidation around some of the manufacturers of EV charging infrastructure. But broadly, that's still a hot topic, particularly around fleets, larger scale and storage, larger scale sort of storage and EV charging infrastructure, co-locations, this kind of stuff. So e-mobility is still hot. Storage and grid is still hot. Solar's picking back up again. There's a lot of hype around hydrogen, but probably not a lot of hiring, I would say.
Izzy's looking at me like, you don't bang on about hydrogen.
We could have a long conversation about hydrogen.
So you do a lot of so you're focused on executive search, which is the management leadership within organizations. So I'm sure you spend a lot of time thinking about what an executive team or a board should look like. So what have you seen over the last 10 years? What's your take on that?
I think certainly people are, and COVID helped with this, I guess, to some extent, the importance of the communication skills and the ability to build and maintain and lead with strong culture. I think that's been the big transition and change generally in my work and experience and in the last 10 years. People clearly need to have a certain skill set. They need to be able to perform to a certain degree. They need to be able to, you know, do the job at hand. But increasingly at leadership, the job at hand has changed from purely an execution one, which is clearly important, but equally to more in terms of that element of leadership and defining culture and communicating. And there's a number of reasons for that, partly because, again, the nature of the workforce is changed. We're getting younger people in, even at executive level, you're still getting younger people in who have different expectations potentially. And you also have, going back to the point of, you know, more remote or hybrid working, and therefore you have to work hard to maintain culture and to actually keep the communication channels open and to make sure people are fully productive. So I think that's the biggest change, is that people now need to, over and above being good at the mechanics of their job, they need to be good at communication, being agile and adept at changing their leadership style, not fundamentally be something different, but to not treat everybody the same in a regimented way. And I think those are challenges that when you've been brought up or perhaps even in a corporate environment where you're much more siloed into this is your job, do this thing, and you don't need to worry too much outside of that. So internally, that's a challenge. And externally, what we're seeing, as you see yourselves, is there's a big convergence of multiple technologies. So, you know, you can't just look at storage and batteries in isolation without thinking about, you know, grid connections, or you can't think about solar without thinking about storage. You can't think of EV charging without thinking about power. So that there's much more of a need for leaders to be aware of broader market conditions and other parts of the market, lots of moving parts. Because it's very difficult, or next to impossible, to define a strategy for your storage business or your solar business or your EV charging business without looking at the market in a more holistic way and having the data and resources and ability to look at how that those industries are collaborating and often converging.
There must be a load of jobs now that didn't exist 10 years ago. You know, I often think about this, like when this AI is going to take all our jobs, blah, blah. And obviously that's not the case. It's just people are going to do different things. And there's a load of jobs now, even product management, which is something I believe heavily in as a magnificent career, isn't really something that existed 20 years ago. What jobs and job titles are being created in this new world of the energy transition that didn't exist 10 years ago?
Clearly, data has changed. So there's a lot now of, I guess, CIO, Chief Information or and Chief Innovation Officer. But that's the other title. A lot of these titles have the acronyms that are not always the same thing in the same company. So sometimes you'll see something that means different things to other companies. But clearly roles in and around innovation and managing and leading innovation, roles around how to utilize data across a business. So those are probably the biggest change in terms of job titles potentially, or where there perhaps weren't seats on the board or seats at the C-suite before. So that's probably a little bit of a change. But mainly roles haven't changed much. It's more how they're handled and what falls under the responsibility of those roles.
Yeah, the CIO one always gets me. There's so many different types of CIO.
We would need a CPO. Is that a chief product officer or is that a chief people officer? And so there's, again, there's, I guess, some of those things which are easy to dig beneath, of course, but there's a lot of misunderstanding. And also, I mean, roles, for example, like a COO, what does a COO do? In every company, you could write, you know, an almost entirely different job description.
The best COOs buy lots of donuts. That's all I know.
I'll make sure to tell Ross to make sure he's
they buy a lot of donuts. No, the CEO is an incredible position, but you've got to be getting donuts out to the team. Come back to the makeup of the board then. So what are you seeing out there and an executive team? What do you see companies focusing on?
I think that's an area where there's perhaps a lack of focus or a lack of thought essentially in what that needs to look like for two reasons. One of which actually what you need in a leadership team and what you need in a board also changes with the stage of the company. You know, if you're in an A round and you're 20 people, that's very different from suddenly you're at a D round, you're international and everything's changing around you. So the actual makeup of the board and makeup of the leadership team evolve as the company changes. Which is different from, obviously, if you come from a corporate environment, it's kind of like governance and these things are the more key factors. You still need an element of that as you scale, particularly if you're going to take on money, of course. But it's more a case of then, around the table, are we fit for purpose for what we are now? So I think board positions, typically you should look at tenure for no more than 2 years. That's not so you can't sort of re-sign a contract, so to speak. But every 2 years, reassess actually what is it that we need right now? And same to a degree with the leadership team. Again, you're going to be changing your leadership team on a regular basis, but you need to think that are they equipped for not just for executing on our current plan, but are these individuals capable and agile enough to perform when the company is in a different situation, when we are in five or six different countries, for example, or when we are in four or five different markets? Are those individuals capable of, we believe, that transition? So I think sometimes people hire for what they need now without clear thought on what is it we need now and in the next 3, 4, 5 years potentially. And it's hard to see that far down the line, of course, in the industry we're in, because it is so dynamic. But looking at anything in isolation, I think, is the danger when you think, or even when you see someone and you see people make hires because this individual had a beautiful set of experiences that were quite rare, and therefore let's get them on board, but without thinking about, well, what are you going to do with those sets of skills, A, now, and B, when your world has shifted a little bit, as it should do. If you want to grow, then by definition, things you need to shift what you're doing and who's doing what. So I think, going back to your point, it's really looking at things on a holistic point of view of what's the journey for the company. And also looking at it from a team perspective, if you put it into a football analogy, you don't need a team full of Mohamed Salahs because it's not going to work. So if you are looking at your board or you're looking at your leadership team, what skills and personalities do you already have and where are the gaps? So that's something, again, I'll just encourage people to look at context rather than purely the skill set of the individual that you need.
Yeah, it's hard, man, because my job as CEO, when we first started the company, my job title was CEO and there's three of us in a room. It was all a bit ridiculous. And then over time, my job's completely changed and changed and changed. And even just holding on to it and performing in that, it's every 6 months, the job description completely changes. And you have to go back. It's like you have to go back and almost rewrite your own story on it.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting. It's a hell of a privilege and I love it, but it's a real challenge.
That's a challenge, but also communicate that, by the way, because again, in terms of the team, because what you're doing for that 6 month period of time, everybody gets, oh, this is what Q's doing, this is what Sotelo's doing. And then, you know, I'm the same, you know, most of my early stage of the company was still actively, you know, hiring board positions and being very much in the business. Now I'm focused on internationalization, growth and fundraising and this kind of stuff. It's different. The title's the same, but actually the job is entirely different. So that's a challenge for the individual and for the hiring, but it's also a challenge then to communicate that into the business so people don't say, well, what the hell is Q doing? That's not what I thought his job was.
Yeah, it used to be everyone's mate and now now he's not. And then it's also hard for the leadership team, right? Because you hire someone in to do the job, and we've definitely been through this, and the job is one thing, and then you say, okay, we're launching in the US, you got to get on a plane.
Yeah.
And they might have young kids, and you know you're saying you got to perform, you got to lead, you got to be present, and that's tricky. And it's not about whether people are capable; it's like, do they want this? Because if the company keeps growing quickly, it's going to just evolve and evolve and evolve. It's hard.
That comes from transparency. Is to be really clear and not BS anybody in the process that this is the direction of travel. You know, and if things go to plan, there will be international travel, there will be time away from home, or there will be exit situation that occurs. Are you comfortable with that? Because at any level, it's costly, but particularly at a board and senior level, if you hire someone and it doesn't work out after 2 or 3 years, that's or even less, then that's really costly. Financially costly, and in terms of your pace of growth, it's costly. So being super transparent right off in terms of what are the warts and all, what is the direction of travel, this is the expectation now, but this is the expectation likely to be coming down the line. And filter out early, people say, well, actually, no, I've got, you know, three kids, or I'm tied to Munich or London or wherever it might happen to be, I'm just not going to be traveling. Then for all the skills that they possess now, they're not the right person to hire. So that element of transparency and being really clear on what is the journey and what is the path look like, I think is important.
Absolutely. And now coming on to the last two. So the first one is, if there's anything you want to plug, this is your chance.
Well, of course, the podcast, which you're kind enough to mention already, Leaders in Cleantech, which I obviously interview entrepreneurs within clean technology. So do check out that. It's on YouTube more recently, but of course, on all the podcast platforms. And Hyperion Executive Search. If you're growing leadership teams, then of course, reach out to me or one of the team. We work in 17 countries. We work exclusively in clean technology. We've been doing this a good period of time. So I'm always uncomfortable plugging too much. People mostly will hopefully have heard of us or know of us, but we can certainly help discreetly if that's a need that you have.
No, plug away. This is the plug section. And then let's get to the contrarian view. So what do you believe that perhaps not the rest of the world believes?
Ah, no, that's good.
Anything's on the table here.
Yeah. I think within the market, I think I'm always probably happy to call out BS, particularly around some technologies that are shoehorned into places they don't belong. And the obvious one is hydrogen. I think it has a great part to play in some parts of the transition, but not in a lot of the places it's promoted. So I guess I'm contrarian in that regards. I'm also quite happy to call out BS where I see it from the status quo companies, oil and gas, for example, energy companies in transition who are greenwashing. There's a lot of that still that goes on. Sadly, there are organizations who acquire businesses to stifle them rather than to grow them. And some of our clients have fallen foul of that in the past, and we've seen it at first hand. So I don't know if that's quite the contrarian thing that you're looking for. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think politics is important. I think it's going to be really interesting what happens in the US if the orange monster gets back in again. But yeah, so I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do think there's a lot of underhand elements that affect our sector in media and from the traditional oil and gas and energy companies, almost like the old tobacco playbook of misinformation or disinformation or overinformation that confuses people, which actually stops us getting to where we need to be from a transition perspective. And fortunately, you know, owning the company, I don't have a corporate PR team that tell me not to say these things, so I can call it out where I see it. But I think it's a genuine thing, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but I think it generally is. There's a lot of things against us in the sector. Some of them are technological, but that's probably the minor things. A lot of it is around the status quo and the people who don't want us to succeed quite as quickly. And that does sound a little bit dark and sort of Machiavellian, but it's the fact that I think we are held back as a sector through policies and primarily through media that sort of want to slow the transition. We could move much more quickly without some of that. From my perspective, we don't have the time to be sitting around. We need to accelerate as quickly as we can, which is why organizations like ours and yours exist. So I'm not sure that's contrarian, but I'm quite happy to call out the fact that there are some darker forces that we need to be aware of and be happy to shout about.
Wow. So yeah, agreed. It's not all plain sailing. The funny thing is on that, I think there are some darker forces. It's funny. I'm not a conspiracist theory, but, which is classic. I think but genuinely, everyone thinks they're doing the right thing. I think, like, for example, there's a big problem with misallocation of capital into projects that don't really make sense and technologies that don't make it sense. And you mentioned this hydrogen silver bullet thing, which I think has now died down. But I think the people trying to build those projects do genuinely believe they're doing the right thing. And so it will come down to, in my opinion, it'll come down to cost and it'll come down to timeliness and expense. And we shall see. But I don't think there's not a Dr. Evil anywhere who's trying to figure out.
No, I don't think there's a Dr. Evil anywhere. I think it's very difficult for some people to transition. But I would say if you're working for an oil and gas company on the oil and gas side, and you wake up every morning knowing what you do is detrimental to the health of the planet and your own children, your own family, I think you've got to ask yourself a question. And a lot of people are uncomfortable asking that question or pointing it out.
The reason why I'm uncomfortable with it is, here's the juice of the conversation. I'm uncomfortable with it because I'm so reliant, and my whole existence is reliant on oil and gas.
Yeah.
And so I worked a bit offshore. I worked in offshore gas for a bit, for Centrica and their upstream organization, and some incredibly bright, committed, fantastic Absolutely. People. And I don't know, I think like, what I'm wary of, and sometimes we do this at Modo, and I always kind of shut it down or try and educate, which is I don't think we should point fingers at the people who are out. Like if you've ever worked 2 weeks on, working 12-hour days on an offshore platform in the middle of the sea in the pissing cold, trying to get gas onshore so people can heat their homes, and then for like people in like a nice office in London living their life saying, you know, what you're doing is immoral.
Yeah,
that feels like a bit that. I can't get comfortable with that.
I think there's two things there. Firstly, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not binary. We have to turn it off tomorrow. Of course, we can't turn off oil and gas tomorrow. The world will collapse, right? That doesn't work. So nobody's saying that. I think you can get, as soon as you start saying we need to transition more quickly, you say, oh, but you know, your iPhone's made of plastic. You know, I know it is. We can't do it overnight. And equally, there are some exceptional people working in these industries. And our vision at Hyperion is to make sure those exceptional people are not working for oil and gas and petrochemicals or those industries, they transition their careers into the transitions. And again, you know, everybody has to feed their family, right? So it is a bit, I do get you can't sit in your ivory tower and say, oh, look, you know, everyone's got to feed their family. You've got to do what's right for you and your family. But I also think that the more people and companies you recognize that their own personal self-interest is in the transition. And I guess that's why sometimes you have to be a little bit controversial and perhaps challenge people in their thinking. Yeah. So
this is why we do the contrarian view, because you get these kind of discussions, which is awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to say a massive thank you for joining us on a podcast, coming down to London to do this in person. It's a real privilege. We are big fans of all the stuff you're doing, so please carry on. 150 episodes. Excited to see what you can do with 300 episodes. And if you're listening to this, repeat, go check out what Hyperion are up to, because there's some awesome content on there. Some great founder stories, which are an inspiration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Transmission, a Modo Energy podcast. Transmission delivers conversations from industry leaders and experts exploring energy markets and the operations and technologies related to grid-scale battery energy storage. Check out our other episodes by searching Transmission wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the Energy Academy, our video crash course on how markets in Great Britain and ERCOT work, or head to modoenergy.com to see our written research. Thanks for listening.